94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, on Apropos of Something, we're talking with Nancy Deutsch, professor at the University of Virginia Curry School of Education and director of YouthNext, the UVA Center to Promote Effective Youth Development. Her research focuses on adolescent development, identity, and the role of after-school programs and mentoring relationships. She has recently become the editor of the Journal of Adolescent Research. Today, we're going to zero in on the importance of two areas of her expertise, the role of after-school programs for youth, especially in these turbulent times, and gender equity and gender-based violence. This Sunday, the Richmond Times-Dispatch will run her op-ed she co-wrote on youth extremism and the role of after-school for prevention of that extremism. This year, she was part of a team that developed and led the campus Gender-Based Violence Institute. She's also part of a 27-college and university consortium, which developed and implemented the Campus Climate Survey on Sexual Assault and Sexual Misconduct. We also have with us the Michael Gilbert, the Sullivan and Cromwell Professor of Law Professor, I said that twice, at the University of Virginia. He teaches courses on legislation, election law, direct democracy, and judicial decision-making. His recent research examines judicial independence, campaign finance disclosure, and the interpretation of ballot initiatives. We're going to take an in-depth look today at the current regime's efforts around voter suppression. You can check out all our past shows on the station website, 947wpvc.org. And now I must ask Nancy Lawrence, are you there?
Question I can totally handle. All those other ones you were talking about, I'm so glad we have guests to deal with those. But yes, I am totally here. I got that. I got it. What else you got for me?
Well,
it's easy.
The whole Harvey Weinstein thing. It just fits in perfectly. Unfortunately, but Emma Thompson said something really great. I thought her profound. She said he's at the top of the ladder of a system of harassment and belittling and bullying and interference. And that what we need to talk about right now is the crisis in masculinity, the crisis of extreme masculinity. And
leave it to us to figure out how to deal with the white male privilege piece of this news, right? I mean, no. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I think you have more to say before I cut in. So
no, you feel free. Just that, you know, who's representing that, the most powerful man in the world at the moment, or seemingly.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, it's another, right, it's another, I think you're saying this, it's another chance for the feigned outrage and the total brain disassociation that we elected someone that more than qualifies in the same way, and you know, we seem to not remember that so well, but it's all about Weinstein, it's all about Hillary should shut up. No, why didn't she speak out about this sooner? No, she's still in some way, you know, they bring that one back to her as well.
Right.
Are you surprised? I mean, that it came out, yes, but once it came out, I'm not surprised. I'll answer for myself that all these women are, you know, the tsunami of women that have, you know, been at the, you know, hands of this guy. It's just not surprising. Sorry, is all. It's sad. I'm not surprised.
But you know how, like, in the Woody Allen film, was it Annie Hall, where Marshall McLuhan came out because he said, "You're not an expert on this, you know, topic." Blah, blah, blah. So I heard this guy Robert J. Lifton talking. He's a leading American psychiatrist, and he's written tons of books, like 20 books on nuclear war, terrorism, genocide, all kinds of things. So he was saying he belongs to a group called the Duty to Warn, which is a group of psychiatrists and psychologists who feel they have the right and the obligation to speak out about Trump's psyche when it endangers the country and the world. I mean, where we need this guy. Put him somewhere. Yeah. Put him in Congress.
I truly do not understand why it is not okay to talk more about Trump's erratic, nonsensical, all of that, his narcissism, you know, the litany. I don't get why it is not talked about more. So to your point, you know, whenever one of those guys comes on a talk show, or women, you know, and talks about his mental state, it's like such a breath of fresh air. Yes, let's talk about this elephant in the room. It's so obvious.
Well, I think
he's
it's so unstable. It's talked about among, you know, our circles or people who think like we do. But then I still see people on Facebook or wherever saying, give him a chance. That just makes my skin crawl. Give him a chance. Give him a chance.
Right. He's a straight shooter. No, he doesn't know what he's saying from one minute to the next. You know, he can't even admit he's so busy being the whole Puerto Rico thing. I would have thought it would bring, you know, highlight once again, you know, he's the victim and he sees things that aren't there. And it's too many people in power are just playing along, you know, playing along, not addressing it.
Mm-hmm. So this, I'll just say one more thing about this guy and then talk about some events coming up in our community. This guy, Robert J. Lifton, said that he talks about a malignant normality, that because he's president, there's a tendency to normalize what he's doing. I know that's, you know, we've talked about that before, but so when it's called normality, what's called normality is completely malignant and harmful, and that he's just behaving in a psychotic way, yet he's not psychotic, really. So it's a really dangerous combination.
Right. I mean, you and I are not arguing, but do we need to parse where the problem is? The most important part is he's running the country. If it's, you know, caused by X or a symptom of X, what's the difference? You know, he's taking us down with him.
Right.
He's so pulling us away from the world and making us so susceptible to who knows what, you know, from our enemies, which continue to grow.
Right.
The end.
So what we can do about that is also a topic of conversation that we're going to have today is we can vote. So upcoming general election is November 7th. The deadline to vote to register or change any registration information is October 16th, which is Monday. This is the biggest election since Trump took office, and we're going to elect a governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and all 100 seats in the House of Delegates. And on the 17th, Tuesday, at Cardinal Hall here in town, there's going to be beer, wine, and kombucha, of course. And you can meet other indivisible members who've been, as they say, pouring their hearts out for the resistance and to see what you can do to help others register and vote or just go vote.
Yeah, I heard Obama, well, you live there. I heard Obama's coming to Virginia to help Mr. Northam.
Is he? I didn't really know that. Is that true? Obama?
No, it's true.
There's some nods on the panel here.
He's coming out of...
Oh, great, Nancy. Good work.
Out of silence. Well, thank you. Yeah. It's a scoop.
All right, so it's very public. No further ado, let's get to our guests. We have a great show. Nancy Deutsch is Youth Next Director, and she is working to mitigate gender-based violence. As I said, you know what? I gave a really long introduction to her.
You did.
I'm just going to skim through some of it. She's a professor at the University of Virginia Curry School of Education, and as I said, the director of Youth Next, which is the UVA Center to Promote Effective Youth Development. She focuses on adolescent development, identity, and the role of after-school programs. And in June of this year, she was part of the team that developed and led the Campus-Based Violence Institute. It was the first national training institute for colleges and universities of this sort, all before Secretary of Education DeVos started to roll back Obama's guidance to address campus sexual violence. And she was also part of a consortium of a lot of other institutions, colleges and universities, that developed and implemented the Campus Climate Survey on Sexual Assault and Sexual Misconduct, which really took a look at what's going on campuses and also here at UVA. I think she interviewed with her team like 20,000 students. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great.
Hey. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Nancy.
And full disclosure, I work closely with Nancy in a communications role, and I can vouch for her accomplishments and the scope and depth of volume of her work and how great she is to work with.
Oh, well, thank you, Ellen.
Yeah, you're
right
welcome.
Back at you.
Well, I was going to get, I thought that was for me. All right, I'm done with the Nancy jokes. Okay, go ahead.
No more Nancy jokes.
No more, that's it.
So 20,000 plus students participated in the survey. What did you find out?
Yeah, so that was a survey. It was actually the 2015 American Association of Universities Campus Climate Survey. And as you mentioned, there were 27 institutions of higher education that participated in that survey. UVA was one of them. And then UVA, I was on the design team for UVA. So what we found was very in line with what historical trends have demonstrated. One in five women still report being sexually assaulted. It was about 23% total across the 27 institutions, although those rates do vary by institution. But I think what's also really important to understand is that the risk is also different for different women. So that women who, people who identify as transgender, genderqueer, gender nonconforming, as well as women of color have higher incidences of sexual assault, reporting higher levels of sexual assault, sexual violence. Women in sororities are also more at risk. So there are particular groups of women on our college campuses and groups of people, students on our college campuses, who are experiencing higher rates than even that one in five number suggests. But I think what's really important and what really is particularly disturbing, given DeVos's recent statements about rolling back the Obama-era guidelines on Title IX, is that it really ignores what's the reality of what's happening on college campuses. So of those assaults that occur on college campuses, less than 30% are actually reported. And it ranges, the AAU survey demonstrated that it ranges from about 5% to 28%, depending on the kind of assault we're talking about, the kind of behavior. But of that, less than 30% that are reported, an even smaller percentage, are reported to law enforcement. And then we know that of those that are reported to law enforcement, only a minuscule amount are prosecuted, and of those, even less, fewer are convicted. So this idea of sort of the big issue being false convictions or false reports is just not held up by the evidence. Only about 2 to 8% of reports of sexual assault turn out to be false allegations. So it's a real misrepresentation of what's actually happening on our campuses.
Yeah, those numbers are so low. What yet have you guys done in terms of the Title IX provisions being so weakened? How will that role change on campuses to, you know, letting people know that you have their back? You know, how are you going to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think that, you know, what's important to realize is that there had been a lot of progress made, right, up until now. So Title IX is a 45-year-old law, right? It was sort of rarely followed. It was pretty misunderstood. And the Obama guidelines really helped provide clarity and guidance to institutions. And there was a lot of progress being made. So at the National Institute that that Ellen mentioned in the introduction, it was actually, I think it was June of 2016 that we ran it, but it was a National Leadership Institute that I partnered with Futures Without Violence and the Harvard Law School Gender Violence Program, and to create this two-day training institute where colleges and universities brought a multi-sector team of people. So it was about six individuals from each institution that participated, and they ranged from, you know, the Title IX officers to campus safety officers to student affairs administrators to a student, right, who worked on those issues, peer educators sometimes, to counselors, and essentially tried to help universities understand how to take a trauma-based approach to sexual violence, to gender-based violence on their campuses, and to work from an ethos of care across every sort of sector that was working on these issues, and to create collaborative teams. And I think that is still what universities need to do, right? It's from sort of centering these issues within a larger climate and culture, and sort of having everybody who's working on these issues come together to address that climate and culture, I think is very important. And in terms of what schools will do from here, you know, my hope is they'll continue to move in that direction. I think that one of the things that's been disturbing for me to watch happen is that DeVos has, and the administration has, inserted this sort of confusion and lack of clarity into the system, into a system that was finally moving forward and making progress. And they've done that at the time that is considered the red zone on college campuses. So we know that, first of all, the AAU survey demonstrated something that we also sort of had already been documented, but it sort of redocumented it, which is that the risk of the most serious kinds of assaults, so that would be physical sexual assault or assault through that includes sort of physical force or incapacitation, that risk declines across the 4 years of college. So you're most at risk in your first year. So in most schools, that's called freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, right? It decreases from freshman year to senior year at UVA. We would call that from first year to fourth year. And then within that, we know that in general, about 6 to 8 weeks, it's sort of that first opening of the first semester of the year is the time when students are most at risk. So she's inserted this sort of uncertainty about what things are going to look like at the time when we know the most sexual assaults are occurring. And that's really disturbing because, as we know, we already have less than 30% of assaults that are reported. And so if students don't know what's going to happen when they report something, they're going to be even less likely to report it. So I think that that's really disturbing.
Yeah, I was just wondering, actually, with all the, you said 25 institutions, were there a lot of commonalities or were you, you know, each having individual problems on your respective campuses?
Yeah, so that I think that there is commonality. So rates do, the sort of incidence and prevalence rates do differ across institutions, but the sort of who is at risk tends to be the same, right? So the level of risk may differ, but what that risk is tends to be the same. So for, you know, LGBTQ populations on campuses tend to be more at risk regardless. Obviously, women also more at risk. So women of color even more at risk. So the subpopulations tend to be similar. But one of the things that I think the Campus Climate Survey really helped with, and again, this is one of those things that I hope they will continue. This was something that the Obama-era guidelines put into place, was this suggestion of doing these campus climate surveys. Again, we don't now know what that's going to look like going forward. But I think those were a powerful tool, a starting place for institutions to allow them to look at their own campuses and find out what the climate looked like for different populations of students. So, for example, at UVA, we were able to look at that and say, okay, you know, if we know that the LGBTQ population, if we know that women of color are more at risk, we can think about how to do particular outreach around those populations. We can then also think about, well, why is that? What is the climate on our campus that is conducive of that? So, you know, I think that we don't always talk about campus gender-based violence as what it really is, which is a microcosm of our larger culture. So, you started with this, with talking about Harvey Weinstein and our president, right, who we all know, and by his own admission, harasses and certainly has been accused of assaulting women. That our campus is a microcosm of our larger culture, and we can't expect it to do anything than reflect our larger culture.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Nancy Deutsch, professor at the University of Virginia, Curry School of Education, director of YouthNext. We'll be right back with more with Nancy Deutsch. This is WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll also talk with law professor Michael Gilbert. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We have the honor of talking with Nancy Deutsch, professor at the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education, director of YouthNext. We were talking about the larger culture, Nancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that, you know, college campuses are, again, microcosms, right, of our larger culture. And you mentioned at the beginning the current reports that have been coming out about Harvey Weinstein and the culture of sexual harassment and sexual assault in Hollywood, and that's coming down from, quite frankly, from the highest levels of our administration, right? And sort of how we think about sexual harassment as a normative part, right, of many cultures and climates. So, you know, one of the things that the AAU survey demonstrated that hasn't been getting necessarily as much press, but I think is really telling, is that nearly 50% of students, so that's of all students at these 27 institutions, across these 27 institutions, reported being victims of sexual harassment. And that number was higher for women and trans, genderqueer, and gender nonconforming students. So 75% of undergraduate students who identify as trans, genderqueer, gender nonconforming report experiencing sexual harassment, and 62% of women report sexual harassment across these 10 institutions. So that is the majority, in some cases, the vast majority of students or of subpopulations of students. And to me, that's what we have to look at changing. If we are, you know, sexual assault is the that coming to its extreme conclusion, right? So I think that that's thinking about how we turn campuses into caring climates and how we sort of think about approaching these issues from an ethos of care, as we talked about in the Leadership Institute. I think that is really important, and that's something campuses have to look at their traditions and their norms and look at where in their traditions and norms they are upholding these larger cultural messages that are part of, you know, rape culture in our society.
I know you're not a lawyer, but I mm-hmm. was reading that
we do have one in the house, so we can turn to him.
But what I was going to say was, I thought I read something about at least one institution who was not going to roll back the mm-hmm. guidelines.
Yeah,
I don't know if it was Kentucky or somewhere else. Are there legal implications for that? Is that something to encourage? I mean, Michael, we'll talk to Michael later. That's his hour. This is your hour. But, you know, what do you think about that? And are there other institutions you've heard of?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think that, you know, the guidelines were actually just that. They were guidelines. So Title IX has existed as law for 45 years. What the guidelines tried to do was to provide clarity about what schools could do to best uphold Title IX on their campuses. So that's an important distinction, right? And in fact, one thing that struck me, there was Diane Rosenfeld, who's a professor of law, who worked on the National Leadership Institute with us from Harvard Law School's gender violence program. She wrote an op-ed right after the DeVos speech. And she actually noted that every example that Secretary DeVos gave in her speech of these sort of egregious issues that were occurring that they're rolling back the guidelines would help address, every one of those issues that she raised actually were illegal under current law and current guidelines. So they were things that the guidelines actually were in place to address. So, for example, that the Obama-era guidelines already requires fair treatment of both parties, right, which is something that she has really, really pushed on. And that it was really about clarity on how to implement requirements of Title IX in a fair and effective manner. Mm-hmm. And I think really importantly, those guidelines reflected decades of work by and behalf of survivors. And that's what's really upsetting to me, is that it feels like this whole push from the administration has now sidelined this work, much of which was done by student activists, right? And activists who themselves had experienced sexual harassment, sexual assault on campuses, to get their voices heard and taken seriously. And is now sort of shifting the narrative in ways they've done in other policies, I'll say also, where they're sort of using the law to twisting it, right? Mm-hmm. The thing that they're doing with sort of race-based admissions policy, flipping it on its head to, in essence, override the rights of the very people the laws were meant to help support,
mm-hmm.
from my non-lawyer point of view.
Yeah. And I wanted just to turn for a moment to talk up before we run out of time, mm-hmm. just to talk about the after-school context that you do a lot of work in and research in, and why you think it's so important. Now, you, as I mentioned, this Sunday's Richmond Times-Dispatch will run an op-ed that you mm-hmm. co-wrote with Joanna Williams from Curry about that and about student activism. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, and I think it's actually a nice link, although it may sound like a jump. It's a really nice link in this topic because, in fact, as I mentioned, I think a lot of what has happened in recent years around Title IX and college campuses was driven by the activism of young people, right? It was driven by students who came forward and said, we are not able to engage in our educational institutions in the way we should be able to because of what's happening to us around issues of sexual harassment, sexual violence. And, you know, that the role of young people in our civic and political process is so, so, so important. And I think we often underestimate the power of young people. So, you know, after school spaces, that happened to have been college students. But when you move down the educational system into the K-12 system, because of the ways in which schools are currently structured and the power of standardized testing, there is less and less room in the formal school day for students to engage in work that might feel very purposeful and meaningful, or I didn't mean purposeful, I meant meaningful and providing a sense of purpose to youth, right? And after school spaces can be a really powerful place for students to have those opportunities. And so the op-ed you mentioned, we actually link it to what happened this summer in Charlottesville and the rise of extremism and white nationalism in particular, and white supremacy in particular. And the ways in which, you know, research from the 90s demonstrated that what was attracting youth to gangs was the fact that gangs were very good at meeting adolescents' basic developmental needs. They provided a sense of safety. They provided a sense of belonging. They provided a sense of meaning and purpose, right? You've got a good, important role in this organization, and you can feel like you belong here. So those are all things that if youth aren't getting from their other social settings, whether it's schools or after-school programs or families, they're going to look for that somewhere. And unfortunately, we found that extremist groups and gangs are quite happy to provide that. And so after-school programs, what my colleague Joanna Williams and I sort of say is that after-school programs can be those spaces, right? They have the opportunity to provide activities that give youth a chance to engage in activity that's meaningful for them. Sometimes that is civic and political activity, right? It might be looking at, there's a lot of civic and political activity that you can do before you can vote, right? And so really helping youth find ways to contribute meaningfully to their communities.
You know, I can't believe I'm asking this question, but has the rise in the first part of it actually has this rise in white supremacy or seeming rise of it made you rethink how you mentor these young kids?
So that is a great question. So you know, I think that one thing that's really important is thinking about the role of adults and the role of role models. I do a lot of work on mentoring and thinking about how we mentor youth. And I will say there are different ways of thinking about this. There's work that's been done around the use of sort of critical race theory in mentoring and sort of engaging with youth from more marginalized backgrounds and explicitly having conversations, right, about social justice, about race, and engaging youth in those discussions. Then I think when we think about those youth who are not from marginalized backgrounds, right? So white youth, but youth who may be susceptible to the messages of white supremacist groups or extremist groups, we can think about how we as adults are engaging them in critical discussions and engaging them in discussions about privilege and about critical understandings of systems of power and privilege. And I think that's really important. So again, I think we can, if we think about those key needs, a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose, right, engaging in work that's meaningful, feeling safe, those are things that as adults we can help youth feel and find constructive and useful ways to engage in activities that promote that. I happen to think after school spaces, including mentoring programs and others, but also other types of after school programs, offer a real powerful tool for that.
Why do you think that is? What is so effective about after school outlets?
Yeah. Well, I think for one, they don't have the curricular demands of school, so they're much more free, right, in terms of what they can engage kids in. Two, there's a lot more space for the development of relationships in after school programs, right? So that the relationships, one thing I found in a lot of my work with after school programs is that consistently youth talk about the power of the relationships with staff there and those relationships as being a key reason that they keep coming back to those programs, right? So they might come for an activity, but then they develop a relationship with the adult who's running that activity, and that relationship sort of can continue to keep them involved and then can be an opportunity for sort of working with that youth. And we don't give as much space in schools for the development of relationships, even though we know that teacher-student relationships are also important.
So, Nancy, thank you so much for being here. Is
thank
there
you
anything
for having me.
You want to leave us with? Maybe something about a conference
yeah,
coming up?
Yeah, so what a coincidence that you mentioned that. So we do have October 26th and 27th. Youth Next is hosting our sixth conference. This year's topic, very timely for those of us in Charlottesville, but also all across the country right now, is social justice and youth civic and political engagement. We have an incredible group of people coming. That includes researchers, of course, but it also includes practitioners, policymakers, and young people themselves, young activists who are going to be talking about an array of issues related to youth civic and political engagement. And that's October 26th and 27th at the University of Virginia. And you can get more information at our Youth Next website.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nancy. Thanks so much for being here, Professor in Education, Curry School of Education, and the Director of Youth Next.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, great. Well, more dismantling, not necessarily Title IX, but I'll squeeze in my news of note, which is from the president. Last week, he urged the Senate Intelligence Committee to investigate American news outlets for publishing those fake stories. And that committee is established to ensure that the government's national security policies don't compromise our constitutional freedoms like freedom of the press. And he was so incensed, as you probably know, with NBC reporting that Tillerson called him a moron this week that he's taken his dictatorial adult daycare outbursts even farther and is now threatening to challenge their licenses, using the power of the government to attack speech he doesn't like. He talks like a despot. He's very much a rocket man, and there's no other way around it.
Okay, Nancy wants to say something.
I wanted to say one more thing just in response to that, Nancy, because I would be remiss when I was leaving to come here. My 5-year-old said to me, Mommy, what you really need to say on the radio is President Trump is stupid. And I said, thank you. I will consider sharing that viewpoint. So it just seemed to link to what you were saying there, Nancy.
Right.
So I thought I would give a shout out to the kindergartners in the audience.
Thanks, Nancy.
Absolutely. And thank you for your child's stupid comment.
Clearly gifted in many ways. And that just proves it.
Yep.
Yes. So I want to get right to our next guest, and we're going to go to a break in about 4 minutes, and we'll come back again with Michael Gilbert. He is the Sullivan Comrell Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. He teaches courses on legislation, election law, direct democracy, and judicial decision-making. His recent research examines judicial independence, campaign finance disclosure, and the interpretation of ballot initiatives. And today we're going to talk mostly about voter suppression and whatever else he wants to talk about. We're very grateful that he's here. So welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Hey.
Good. So what is going on? I know there's a big Supreme Court case going on in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit? Is it a gerrymandering case? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's what's going on. So a week and a half ago, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case about partisan gerrymandering there. And the facts will make this plain. So in 2010, Republicans controlled Wisconsin's government, the legislature, and the governorship for the first time in something like 40 years. So they had to redraw the lines, and they didn't have to compromise with Democrats to do it. So they gerrymandered, which is predictable, and their gerrymander seemed to be especially effective. So in 2012, the first election with these new lines in place, Republicans statewide won about 49% of the vote for races for the lower house and the legislature, but they got about 60% of the seats, so less than half the vote and a substantial majority of seats. So it wasn't just a gerrymander, it was a very effective gerrymander.
Mm-hmm.
And some plaintiffs challenged this, and it's made its way to the Supreme Court.
Well, why does it, I don't want to waste too much time on this, but why does that happen that these cases always wind up in the Supreme Court when, like, the Wisconsin federal court struck it down? Why does it always get up there with those people that are always, with Kennedy always being the wild card?
Yeah, excuse me. So Kennedy's the key here, as usual, and a little bit of background might help. So this is the third case the Supreme Court has ever heard about partisan gerrymandering. And a quick summary of the two that came before: the court has never struck a districting plan down for being an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. But the court has said, nevertheless, there is some limit that we won't allow states to cross. But we're not going to tell you what it is because we haven't figured it out for ourselves. And Kennedy's the swing vote here. So in the last case on this, everything turned on him, and everyone thinks that'll be true again this time around, and we just wait to see what he's going to do.
Do you have a feeling on what side, you know, what's your feeling?
So it's very hard to predict. I mean, a lot of people mentioned, and I noticed this too, during the oral argument, Kennedy's comments were focused on just one side, and it was basically the side that was trying to defend this gerrymander. So you can try to read the tea leaves. It sounds like he's hostile to this. Maybe he'll side with the liberal justices and they'll strike this scheme down. But it's no sure thing. The policy matter is pretty straightforward for lots of people, including me. It just seems like a really bad idea to let these guys draw their own lines. I mean, the potential for self-dealing is so obvious. And there's another thing, too, because they benefit from it, they spend a lot of time on it. Well, I don't want them to spend their time drawing district lines. I want them to govern. So the argument for taking the power away from them as a policy matter is pretty strong. But the legal argument is a lot tougher, and that's why we get stuck in court. The Constitution doesn't explicitly forbid gerrymandering. We've been doing it for 200 years. You have to really read between the lines to find a constitutional hook here. And the court really does have this line-drawing problem. Well, it's kind of two problems. There's a measurement problem and a line-drawing problem. The first thing is you have to measure the extent of the gerrymander, because you want to be able to say, oh, Wisconsin's is really bad, whereas Virginia's is so-so, and maybe, I don't know, Montana's is not so bad. So you need some mechanism for measuring these things, and we don't really have that. And then second of all, you need to figure out where you're going to draw a line in the sand so that the gerrymanders that cross the line are unconstitutional and the rest are not. These are hard problems for the court.
We're talking with Michael Gilbert, the Sullivan and Cromwell Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. This is Apropos of Something. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with law professor Michael Gilbert. So we've been talking a lot about gerrymandering. I also want to know about the whole Kobach thing in Kansas and voter suppression and voter ID. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so there's so much to say about Chris Kobach. So this guy, he is the Secretary of State in Kansas, which means he's in charge of elections in that state. And he is also the vice chair, but I think effectively the chair of President Trump's Commission on Election Integrity. And he's famous or infamous for a couple of things. One is his hardline view on immigration. And another thing related to that is he is a kind of, he has a fanatic belief that voter fraud is a widespread problem in Kansas and elsewhere in this country. And the reason I say fanatic is that no amount of evidence seemingly will persuade him that this is not true. So just to give you an example, he persuaded the legislature in Kansas to give him a power that no other Secretary of State in the country has. And it's the power for him in his official capacity to prosecute people for voter fraud. Normally, this would run through normal prosecution channels. But he has the authority himself. And of course, he wants to use it. So he spent about 2 years trying to find and prosecute people for voter fraud. He's devoted a lot of resources to this. And I think he's come up with about 9 or 10 cases in Kansas. This is over a number of election cycles. So we're talking about something like 2 million votes cast, and he's come up with 10 cases. And most of these cases, I think only one or two of them, involve non-citizens voting. Most of the cases look like this. You've got a person who owns a house in Kansas and also in Colorado, and they can only vote in one place. That's the law, and they get confused and they vote in both. It's true. That's technically voter fraud. It's against the law. But this is not the kind of widespread, systematic, intentional problem that Kobach would have you believe.
And it really does affect people who disproportionately who are African American or elderly. This is maybe off your expertise, but what do you think is going on? Is it simply racism and power issue, or what is it?
Well, right. So just let me take half a step back, if I may. So among other things, Kobach has promoted, as a number of states around the country have in the last 10 years or so, these voter ID requirements. And then Kobach has upped the ante in Kansas. He also wants people to prove their citizenship before they can vote. And so this is what you're getting at. These kinds of laws, the argument goes, are going to suppress the vote. There's a slice of the population that they're American citizens. They have the same right to vote that the rest of us do, but they don't have a driver's license. They take the bus, or they're, you know, they're elderly or other. They're not in a position to drive, whatever. And what's more, they can't readily get these documents. So that's the kind of argument. They can't get a hold of this stuff, and you're putting an impediment in the way of their voting. It's analogous in some sense to a poll tax or something like that. So what's inspiring these things? Of course, if you ask the legislators who are promoting them, they'll tell you it's voter fraud, and this is supposed to help, and we can talk more about that if you like. Are they actually motivated by a belief that voter fraud is a problem? I think some of them sincerely believe that, notwithstanding the evidence. For others, it's politics. Right? They think, and they're probably right, that among those people who don't have ID and can't readily get it, they're going to tend to vote on the left. And what kinds of legislatures are pushing these voter ID laws? It's systematically Republican legislatures. You asked about racism, too, I should say. There's something interesting on this. In two states, North Carolina and Texas, the legislatures have implemented voter ID laws. And in both places, those voter ID laws have been struck down by courts. And those two sets of cases are remarkable because in both of them, a court concluded that the state, in passing the law, intentionally discriminated against racial minorities. So forget whatever effect it's having. Their objective in passing the law was to discriminate. And that's really striking. Courts don't exactly leap at the opportunity to accuse a state government of intentional racism.
What did Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions do about, didn't he rescind that in Texas?
Or? Yeah, that's okay. So I don't know all the details of this, but I know a little bit. So now that he is in charge of the Justice Department, and it was the Justice Department under President Obama that had initiated some of the litigation in Texas, Sessions is in a position now to change the kind of case that the DOJ is bringing. So I don't know the exact details, but they dropped one of the claims. And I think you're right about this. I think they dropped the claim that it was intentional.
And I was wrong about his name. I believe it's Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, interestingly.
Well, you got the Beauregard part, which is most important.
Beauregard.
Yeah. You know, I was wondering about, just briefly on Kobach again, Mike, you know, it's under the guise, of course, that it's election integrity, and, you know, I would put that in quotes for sure. What always frightens me about this administration is that they somehow always manage to do things without the law. You know, it's an executive order, or in short. So that when they have found that amendment that he wanted to propose to the voting rights, this idea of requiring a proof of citizenship in order to register, do you know, can they, meaning the administration, can they accomplish this without Congress or anyone else? Can they just mandate it as they do?
So I think the answer is no. And maybe I'll just give a little background on what's going on here, because it's been in the news lately. So Kobach, as you know, was photographed going into a meeting with President Trump, and he was carrying this mysterious binder, and the photograph caught some, but only some, of the language on the front of the binder. And meanwhile, he's involved in litigation in Kansas over the legality of this proof of citizenship requirement. And the opposing party saw this photo and basically said, as a matter of discovery, we want to see what's in that binder. And he didn't want to hand it over. He said, oh, it's not relevant. And turned out it was relevant. And now he's been fined for intentionally misleading a court. But basically what's going on here is that his proof of citizenship requirement, which is a matter of state law, is in conflict with a federal statute, the National Voter Registration Act, which was passed, you know, in the early 1990s. And because it's federal law, it trumps state law. Okay, so what Kobach wants to do, and what the documents in that binder showed, was that he would like to amend that federal statute so that it is no longer in the way of him or any other state legislature imposing a citizenship requirement. That's what's going on here. But I don't think they can accomplish that without going through Congress.
Okay. And as far as the Voting Rights Act, why is it that it is so susceptible to states and their gerrymandering motives? What happened to it?
Well, okay, so I think you're referring to Section 5 of the Voting Rights
yeah.
Act. So, okay, so this,
yeah.
you know, this act dates to 1965. It's this landmark of civil rights and voting legislation. And for lawyers, it has two especially important parts, Section 2 and Section 5. Now, here's what Section 5 did. It identified a handful of states and other kind of local units of government, too. These are so-called covered jurisdictions. And these were places that had, at the time of the passage of the act, especially bad track records with respect to minority voting. Basically, it was the Jim Crow South. And what Section 5 did, Section 5 plus some Supreme Court interpretations of it, said, listen, if you're one of these covered jurisdictions, you can't make any changes to your election administration. You can't change, you know, you can't impose a voter ID law, for example, or change other voting practices or procedures without first getting permission or clearance from a federal court or from the Department of Justice. So the idea was to kind of just prevent them from constantly coming up with new ways to suppress, especially African-American votes. Now, in a case called Shelby County, just a couple years back, a few years ago, the Supreme Court essentially struck down that section. It said, you can't do this anymore. The formula is out of date. So the covered jurisdictions that were still subject to out of this, some of them look like pretty good actors now. There are other states that aren't covered jurisdictions that look like relatively bad actors. So sorry, Congress, but you can't do this anymore. You need a new formula. Of course, Congress is paralyzed. They're not going to pass a new formula. So what this means is all these states that previously couldn't make changes without first getting preclearance from a court or the Department of Justice, now they can do what they want. And you saw this immediately after that case came down. North Carolina and Texas, legislators in both places announced that we are straight away going to make a big raft of changes to our voting laws, including imposing voter ID requirements. And these are some of the requirements I mentioned earlier that courts have since struck down on the ground that they're intentionally discriminatory.
As a lawyer, what do you think about the whole, just to bring it into a general question, a lot of people think that we have protections. We're supposed to have protections from the branches of government. Do you feel like that is happening? That the Trump administration would be able to just dismantle democracy as we know it, or do you think there's any hope for our branches helping?
Boy. You know, I'm a mousy lawyer. I'm supposed to answer technical questions, not broad ones. I think that although there are lots of policy things happening in the world right now that I'm not so happy about, I think our institutions are pretty resilient, and I don't think this is all going to collapse.
That's what we want. We just need a little bit of hope.
No, I mean, I think that's right. You know, the courts are, I think, doing a reasonably good job of what they're supposed to be doing. The travel ban cases and things demonstrate this. President Trump does not have free rein to do whatever he wants. And if the other branches can stall for a while, we'll have another election and things may change around.
Yes.
You know, even though the Supreme Court and circuit courts have said that voter ID laws are not required, why do states can, well, I get, states continue to do this. Why do they have this wiggle room to keep throwing elections in question, who can vote and who cannot vote, it seems, every 2 years?
Yeah, okay, so I'll tell you about a case. It's a case called Crawford. The Supreme Court decided this case it's about 10 years ago now. And this is the case that really opened the door to the spread of voter ID laws around the country. So Indiana implemented a voter ID law. Some people challenged it in court, essentially saying the things we talked about earlier. It burdens some people's right to vote, and that's a violation of the Constitution. The problem, especially in that case for the people challenging it, is that although as a matter of theory, a voter ID law is going to suppress some votes, as a matter of evidence, they had almost none. They couldn't really point to very many people who had clearly been disenfranchised as a consequence of this. Meanwhile, the state says, well, we want to protect our election integrity, and a voter ID law is a way to do it. Now, of course, the state was in a crazy position, too, because they had no evidence of voter fraud. They couldn't find a single instance of in-person voter fraud, which is the only kind of voter fraud a voter ID law stops, in Indiana history. As far as they could tell, it had never actually happened. So the court was in a tough spot. The plaintiffs are complaining, but they don't have any evidence. The state's saying, don't we have some authority to protect our elections? Well, that seems reasonable, but you don't have any evidence. The court basically said, all right, we don't know what to do. We're going to leave it to the states. You have discretion to do this. Not necessarily in every case, but at least there. And that's the case that opened the door to all these laws spreading.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Professor Michael Gilbert, Professor of Law at the University of Virginia.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that everyone needs to vote.
And you can go online to register if you haven't until by Monday.
Right. Okay. So I have a palate cleanser it's a very personal palate cleanser to cleanse the palate, ironically.
Okay.
And it's about the Yankees. They came back from a 0-2 deficit in the division series against Cleveland. They have to win three in the division series, and they were down 0-2. They won three in a row. They are now in the championship series against Houston. It was miraculous.
They were backs
against the wall, actually, in the wild card game, if you want to know too much.
I'm so happy.
Sure you don't.
I'm just happy
for you.
So anyway,
it's amazing. They're still alive, and I couldn't be happier.
I did watch a little bit of the Nationals-Cubs games series.
Yeah, there you go.
That was fun. I do have a palate cleanser today, which is the Persimmon Festival is happening the 28th of October, to believe.
I knew there was a special bounce in your voice today.
I know.
Why didn't I connect the two?
They're orange and they're delicious, so I would tell people, orange. Go to Edible Landscaping, which is around Afton Mountain here on Saturday, October 28th. It's really, really great. Like, they take you around through the orchard. You get to taste the fruit. You can buy plants. They have many other things more than just persimmons, but it's persimmon season.
I did not know that. Do you know the season? I don't mean to make you a horticulturalist, but is it a short season, a long season? What are we in for here?
It's approximately, they're ripening on the vine now. You may see them, at least around here, you can see the wild persimmons. They're little tiny baby ones. I just picked them. But they'll probably be ripe by the 28th. That's about it. It's about, it's about a week or so, a couple weeks season.
You got a favorite recipe that these go into, or what's your hankering?
No, I just like to eat them raw. They're amazing. Yeah. But they are very astringent. I think a lot of people have tasted them. And tell me if I'm going on too long, because...
No. Me? No.
If you taste a persimmon before they're ripe, it's this astringent effect, and it tastes like the worst kind of tannin, and you have no saliva left in your mouth whatsoever. So it's just that it's not ripe yet. So you just make sure they're nice and ripe.
You know, nature can obviously cuts both ways. It's beautiful, and then it can be astringent. So
that's
the lesson here for me. Anyway, I can't speak for the rest of the people.
Yes. Wanted to talk a little bit about next week's show.
Okay.
We're going to have an expert, Manuela Achilles, is going to talk about German history. We're going to get into a little bit of the Weimar Republic, Nazi Germany, and things like that, and bring it into what's going on today. And do you know the other guest? Cybersecurity, I believe.
Yes, Jason Belford. Works at your school, actually.
Mm-hmm, UVA. And we're going to talk about all things cybersecurity and information technology and things like that. We'll get into some spy things like we've done in the past.
Yeah, maybe he'll probably just check the computer this week. He'll probably hack in and leave some fingerprints that we need to discuss next week or something.
Anyway, I want to leave the show and say thank you to all of our guests, Nancy Deutsch, Michael Gilbert, and also just remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something.
Okay.
Bye, Nance.
Bye.